Position number 16808, Rule 23.
Spittles are Regal 23.
And we used to get these rumours and that, what was happening, and like through the grapevine. And we understood that we'd be travelling through the night and we would be crossing into Holland from Belgium. Well, of course, there was no sort of mark to show that you'd crossed. And you, in a tank, in those sort of movements, you don't travel consistently all the time. You come to a halt. And they used to have a drill march when they was going on a long march for vehicles. And generally used to stop every 2 hours. And according to what time you started, they would say, we will stop every even hour or every odd hour. So if you started at 1 o'clock, the next stop would be 3 o'clock. If you started at 12 o'clock, the next stop would be 2 o'clock. So you had odds and evens, but it meant that you traveled for 2 hours and then the whole column would stop. The ranks would close up any distances you'd lost in your convoy, and then for whatever they'd do, check the vehicle over, and if they felt it was needed, you'd perhaps get a brew on, or at least you should have filled your flasks up at your last, at the start of your journey, so you could always get a cup of tea on. And this is how you progress, you see. Well, it did mean that as you went through these villages, obviously with twists and turns, that the column would slow down to a walking pace and all that. And as I say, every 2 hours you came to a complete stop. And during one of these stops, we were actually out in the country. We were not in a town or a village or anything. But you always had these scattered cottages or farms or whatever. And suddenly, a bloke climbed up on the side of my tank and scrambled up the side and grabbed hold of me around the shoulders. And jabbering away, well, jabbering to me, talking away, quite excitedly, and crying his eyes out with relief at seeing us. And as he was talking, I suddenly realised that he was talking different to what they'd been talking previously, you see. So I thought, oh, I bet we're in Holland. So a funny situation arose, because I said to him, are we in Holland? Yeah, yeah, he said, Hollands, Hollands. So I said, oh, good. So I said, you're Dutch. He started getting waving his, nay, 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 nay. He said, Nix Deutsch, Hollander, Hollander. I said, yeah, in Holland. Yeah, yeah, Holland, Holland. I thought, well, I don't know, I'd better say Dutch again. He nearly went by me. Well, I didn't realise at the time, you see, that when you travelled up from Normandy initially, you used to see the civilians, when you got to see civilians, and you say, German, Jerry's, and to them they'd say, oh, Le Bosch. You see, in Normandy, in France, it was Le Bosch. But when you got into Belgium, it was Allemans. And when you get into Holland, it's Le Deutsch Soldat. So when I said to him, are you Dutch? He thought I said Deutsch. And I said, I thought I was going to shoot him or something. Because I didn't know. And of course, it struck us as rather funny. So anyway, Abin sort of calmed it down again. And sort of, you jabber away, you sort of try to talk, and there was that and the other. And he gave me something in my hand, which turned out to be a silver 2.5 guilder coin. Well, at the time, in the light as it was, it looked like a medal. It's like an old English 5 bob piece, as we used to call it. And if you didn't know, for those people listening, a 5 shilling piece in the old days was always referred to as a crown. Because in our old money, we used to have sixpences, shillings, 2 shillings, 2 and 6pence, which was half a crown, and a 5 shilling piece, which was a crown. So, and this, in the dark, he gave me, it was of a similar shape and similar size as a crown, and very heavy. Anyway, I just thanked him and put it in my pocket, not knowing at the time really what it was. And it was later that I realised, when I saw it in daylight, that it's a 2.5 guilder coin, which I still have. And anyway, we've got to get on the move again. And whether they needed the food or not, you didn't sort of know. But we always got tons of food in the tanks, because we didn't have a lot of time to eat it all. And so we used to designate one of the toolboxes as our food place. And so I indicated that, and he flipped the lid open and helped himself to these little small tins of bully beef we had, and one or two other things. And that was the end of job day, and the column got on the move again, and we carried on to Eindhoven. But this was just a little interlude on the way, you see. Well, the story of the 2.5 guilder coin wasn't made important to me, other than the incident itself, that it was nice to think that this bloke was so pleased to want to give something to the first Allied soldier that he'd had a chance to talk to. But when I went to Belgium in 1947 with the wife and the daughter to stay with friends in Bruges that I'd made earlier, I was talking to Gaston and we was reminiscing about certain things, and I said about this 2.5 guilder coin. And he said, "You still have it, Reg?" I said, "Oh yes," I said, "I still have it." I said, "It's a beautiful coin." He said, "Do you know," he said, "if that man had been found in 1944 with that coin in his possession, he would either went to prison or been deported to Germany on labour." He said, because what had happened apparently, as the war progressed and the occupation of Europe, the Germans initially were very friendly, but as time went on, they started to look round for things, materials that they could use in their war effort. As the war went on, they started, their circumstances started deteriorating, the same as everybody else. And metals became very important. Well, the 2.5 guilder coin is supposedly to be 90% silver. And all the guilders larger than larger denominations than the 2.5, are all silver coins. And so the Germans confiscated all those later on in the war, and initially just said, well, if you hand them in, we'll give you a sort of an equivalent in value in their own coinage, which was like pig iron, really. It was dull coins and with swastikas on and that, which so they was issuing as currency. And of course, as soon as they started doing this, of course, the locals started hiding their own coinage, which was sort of worth having. It was proper nickel and things like that. Well, the guilders, the single guilder coin, is only sort of a normal coinage material, like the same as our coins we have now. So it wasn't a particular high value. But the 2.5 guilders at 90% silver, so the Germans wanted all those, and any guilders of a higher denomination because of the value of the content, you see. And initially, people handed them in, but when it got to the point where the Germans sort of realised there's still some about, then of course they made it a law that if they were caught with one, then you were punished. And Gaston told me that had this man been found with that in his pocket in 1944, he could have either went to prison or been deported to Germany. So he said, that was a very brave man. So, again, as I say, that coin has a bit more value to me in that respect. Anyway, we carried on and we eventually get to Eindhoven. And it was in the afternoon, sort of getting on towards what we, in England, we say tea time, so you're thinking of about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the town was full of American paras. And these were elements of the 101st American Airborne Division. Their divisional sign is a big eagle's head, the North American Eagle. And so naturally they nicknamed them Screaming Eagles. And they were all walking around on tiptoe, as though their sort of heels hurt them. Well, apparently, I understood anyway, that what had happened when they landed, they hadn't landed correctly, and instead of landing and rolling or whatever they do, they landed too rigid and jarred all the tendons in the legs and the spine, so they couldn't bend. And they were walking round with their arms straight down, basically on tiptoe, the heels were off the floor, and they were just wobbling, basically wobbling round, it was most peculiar. And there seemed to be hundreds of them all walking round. I mean, they'd landed, flown all the way from England, and immediately became casualties, simply because of the clumsy way they landed. So they were not fit for fighting anymore. And that was my impression when we landed, when we arrived in Eindhoven. But that was supposed to be an occupied area, but there was some shelling started up, and the Philips radio works, big Philips radio works there, that was hit and set on fire while we were there. And then as I said before, these regular regiments and desert people, they seem to be very foremost in looking after your comforts. And so almost immediately the liaison officer, or whoever he was out looking for a suitable place where we could bill it down for the night, you see. With plans being, I suppose, I thought it a bit too late to start off up the corridor now, so we'll wait till daylight, you see, and tonight we'll spend in maintaining the tanks, getting cleaned up and one thing or another, ready for the dash up the corridor. And after about an hour, we were talking to different people and that sort of thing, and then if you didn't talk to someone, someone in your lot spoke to you who'd spoken to someone, so gradually you get these little stories come round. And the drift of it was that things were not going right, that the drops hadn't brought the solution to what they'd planned, that there was a lot of trouble. And the outcome of it was that about 7 o'clock, we got on the move again, mounted up, and were pushed up into the corridor. It appears that the Germans were having a bit more success than had been anticipated, and were making a nuisance of themselves by cutting the corridor. And the weather had broken, it was pouring rain, and of course the roads were becoming muddy and dirty. And as I said before, because of the heavy traffic and the Guards Army Division having gone up there with all their tanks, culverts were breaking, the pioneers were up there working, the sappers were up there repairing bridges, and the way the vehicle tanks had gone in the dikes of the side, they'd had to get them out and repair the banks of the dikes and everything. And it was a right shambles. And so we decided that the job we had intended to do, that was finished. There was no thought of that happening. But they could use us to support the airborne people on the ground, to give them a bit heavy support with our tanks, which they appears they hadn't got themselves. Being airborne, they were sort of lightly equipped compared to an infantry mob. And so areas were given for us to go and protect. Well, my squadron, which again was B squadron of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, we went up in the corridor and we went up to a town called Vegel. That's a V-E-G-H-E-L. And it was the top marker, as you might say, because when units are given areas, they're given a designated area of which is their responsibility. And the idea was that the 101st American Airborne Division would land. Eindhoven was the main drop, and then they proceeded to go north towards Eindhoven, towards Nijmegen, where the 82nd American Airborne Division had dropped, just south of the of Nijmegen Bridge. And their responsibility was a bridge at Graves, one at a place called Sun, S-O-N, and Nijmegen Bridge itself. Well, they hadn't been able to take Nijmegen Bridge. It appears that the Germans had blown the bridge at Sun, so the Reimers were having to put a new bridge up there, which delayed everything. And there's a gap between the north of the area that the 101st were responsible for and the south of the 82nd. And that gap was very lightly held. The Germans were cutting it and all sorts of things. And Vagel was at the top end. And so it was very tricky because it was meeting the brunt of the German attacks, because that was the weakest link between the two airborne divisions. Well, that was given to B Squadron of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment as air area to patrol, and it gave you sort of, I don't know for sure, but as a, just as an example, say 3 miles above and below Vagel was our responsibility. I mean, it might have been 10 miles, but they gave you a mileage area above and below the town, and that area on the road became your responsibility in conjunction with the elements of the 101st Airborne Division to keep it open for through traffic. I mean, they got ambulances and things to go up. The Guards Army Division, their supply lorries and things had got to come up the road through Vagel. So the idea was to keep the road open, you see. And so we were operating with the airborne. And I didn't know at the time, you see, because as I told you, we had no maps. We still hadn't received any new maps of the area. It was sort of verbal and handed down. So by the time we got to me, a mere troop corporal, I mean, you can imagine the information I got was very sparse. And it was more or less follow me leader type of thing. But anyway, I didn't know why, but I knew that we were fighting on the coastal side of the road, the main road, that is east, going east, and back towards the channel, as you might say, or the North Sea. And it didn't occur to me at the time, but we were not bothered about protection the other side of the road. What I didn't know was that the 11th Armoured Division were also flanking the Guards Armoured Division. People don't seem to realise this, that they say Arnhem, Airborne, Guards Armoured, Americans. But the 11th Armoured Division were also there. But they were responsible for the right-hand protection and following up alongside the Guards almost head-to-head. And it was the 11th Armoured who were making it possible that I didn't realise at the time, but it just seemed that the war was only one side of the road as far as we were concerned. We were never bothered about the other side, but of course we wouldn't. 11th Armoured Division were there, but we didn't know that at the time. And as I say, although our communications are always good, because every tank has a wireless set, if you haven't got any maps of the district and anything, and it's all verbal what's happening, your information is very limited to what we're normally used to having. So we never knew, well, I never knew, that the 11th Armoured Division were actually there, and that's why there was no problems that side of the road. So our problem was the east side of the road towards the coast.
The east side?
Going towards the channel. Like, as you go from Eindhoven to Arnhem, I assume that's probably south to north. So the channel, the sea would be east, if you assume Eindhoven to be south and Arnhem to be north. But anyway, we were supporting these Americans, and it was rather peculiar really, because having got up to our designated area, and as I say, the weather was terrible, it was atrocious weather, and the funny thing was that prior to Dunkirk, the Pioneer Corps never carried arms. They were never equipped with arms, rifles and such like that. And it was Dunkirk that made somebody realise that there they were with men fit that couldn't defend themselves. So after Dunkirk, the Pioneer Corps were armed with weapons and had to become basically infantry in that respect, that they should be able to defend themselves. And when we went up the corridor, it was the first time that I'd ever seen pioneers working, to be honest. And the pioneers in normal times was usually made up of a big proportion of people that were not considered to be fit for a line regiment. So therefore, it became a bit derogatory for a person to say, "What mob are you then?" So, "I'm in a Pioneer Corps." And immediately, you look down on that person. Pioneer Corps. It's almost as bad as the Catering Corps. And people always say, "Well, I was in the Catering Corps." I assume straight away that you don't connect fighting with the Catering Corps or the Pioneer Corps. And I say this had been an accepted opinion that I'd sort of live with, that this was the situation. And this was the first time that I'd seen pioneers actually working. And since then, nobody can tell me anything about a Pioneer Corps. The job they was doing, they were stripped at a waist, they were pulling around, they got a pair of old wellies on, the rifles and the kit was all chucked to one side, and there they were repairing these dikes and ditches. And, you just had to admire them. But anyway, we gets up there, and all this was going on. And the funny thing was, when we got there, of course, we rolled into Vagel, and there's all these American paras wandering about. And when it was sorted and the troops were given definite places to go to, we goes out into the country, we used to refer to it, and gets out. There's all these American airborne and paras and that all dug in around the countryside. And when we rolls up, I always remember this big young sergeant come up. He said, "God, are we glad to see you guys." He said, "I guess we can get the shit out of here now." You know, real typical John Wayne stuff. And, I said, "You better have a word with my officer." And, he went over to see my troop officer. And when he found out that they were not going to be shifted, because naturally they'd been planned, they only got plans like everybody, and they understood that the maximum time they would be there would be 72 hours. And by then, the situation would be resolved, and they would be thinking of withdrawing, you see. And we suddenly rose up, and they're informed that we're there to support them, and they're to carry on, and in effect became our infantry. And because our infantry was nowhere about, you see, they were still down in Belgium or somewhere. And so, God, I was out to play with these Yanks when they found out. And it was rather funny because they'd then dropped the rations for them, and they'd been dropping British rations, not American rations. And they were all these big K-pack rations, beautiful rations they were, puddings and everything in them. And the only thing the Americans liked out of them was the Churchill cigarettes, the Cadbury's and Bourneville chocolate, and the we used to have a big box of sweets, glucose sweets, in a big brown tin. And they liked those. They were basically the only three things that they liked. And all these puddings and bacon, stuff like that, they thought it was rubbish. They wanted candy, I think. Typical, they wanted sort of fancy stuff, like, you know, instead of good old fashioned British grub. And these foxholes were full of them. I mean, afterwards, when the civvies got to realise, I think, God, it's a gold mine, because they were rations for life, you know, like the Americans had left behind. But anyway, the fighting went on, and it was very, very bad. The Germans were very determined about it, and it was the only time in the war that we had to be pulled out of action, because the firing we did was so prolonged that when we load shells up in a tank, we always wipe them down, in our case with aeroplane fuel, aviation spirit. But in any case, if it was ordinary tanks, you wipe them down with petrol, and you wipe off any surplus grease when you stow them into the tank, you see. Because the thing is, when you fire them, the heat in the breech will extract any grease that's in the pores of the brass and gradually grease up extraction pins in the breech block. And the mechanism, firing mechanism, they get covered in grease, and eventually you get seized up, your gun seizes up. It's amazing. Well, I've never heard of it. Again, it's the thing that they teach you in training. They say it can happen, but it never will. And of course, there's tons of time when it does. And so Bill Baggerly, who was my operator, and he also loads the gun, by now he was putting these shells in, and he got a big wad of cotton waste like a boxing glove, and he was virtually having to punch them in. And he got to the point where he said, "Can't get them in anymore, Reg." He said, "Look at that." He got one in, it was sticking out about 3 inches. He said, "I can't get it in any further." I said, "Well, you better get it out before you get it jammed, and we can't get it out." So we managed to get it out, reported this, the situation. We couldn't fire a gun anymore. Well, it appears this was happening all over the squadron. Whether it was happening over the regiment, I don't know, but it was happening in our squadron. And so the squadron was pulled out, and we went into Vagel, it seemed as though the road ran up through the town, and in Belgium, they seemed to have a marketplace at the side of the main road, so the main road sort of ran along one side of the marketplace. Wide enough, anyway, for the squadron to pull the tanks in and without blocking the road up. And the idea was that we would do gun maintenance, you see. And so we did that, and stripped the guns down and cleaned them, the two machine guns. We took the opportunity to clean the brain gun, because although we hadn't used it, it was in the toolbox and got covered in dust and dirt. So we did all this gun cleaning, you see. Well, when we stripped the main gun down, it's a big breech block and it's very heavy, and you can't do it by yourself. So I gave the old Denny Wells my gunner, I gave him help with that. And we stripped it down, and then I let Denny to clean it up and all that. And we got some hot water, boiled the barrel out. We did a proper job, like boiled the barrel and everything. Got the old scouring pads out on the rods and really done it, like, you know, because you have these long rods which you screw together and ram it up and down. And then you've got all sorts of gauze brushes and things to clean the sides and the rifling up the barrels and everything. Anyway, we did a really good job, and it was all right, smashing, like you say. Well, I was outside when Denny was ready to reassemble the gun, you see. So I climbs in and gives him a hand. And when you've got the breech block up into a certain position, then you can leave it for himself to finish it off. So I climbs back out of the turret and leaves Denny inside. He finishes it off, and then he comes out. He said, "I'm not holding it up, Reg." He said, "I've just left it for you to have a look at and see if you're satisfied that it's all right," you see. And he said, "And I haven't put a mechanism in." He said, "I left that because it's a thing by itself, you see. About as big as a little jug, and it's all a complete unit. So you just push it in, give it a twist, and it's and that's the firing mechanism that goes in the block." So he said, "I've left the firing mechanism out." He said, "I'll let you put that in." So I said, "All right." So I climbs in when it was convenient, has a look round, inspects it, clanks the gun up and down with a hand lever. The block says everything's all right, so I thought, well, I might as well oil it up now. So I gets the old can and oils everything all up, so it was all ready. Puts the firing mechanism in, and because when you put it in, it automatically primes it. So you have to click the firing, the side, there's a little plunger thing, you push that, and it fires the mechanism so the pin goes forward, you see. But of course, when you drop the breech block to put a shell in, it automatically primes the firing mechanism and the pin is drawn back again. But when it's not, when it's the gun's clear, then of course if the mechanism's fired, as we call it, then the pin is forward, you see. Anyway, I put the firing mechanism in when I hold everything all up, presses the plunger so that fires the mechanism, as we refer to it. And I thought, well, we're going back in action, I might as well put a shell in, you see. And the repercussions of this were very, well, dramatic, really. I ducked under the gun because you've got a big shield at the back and a big canvas chute hanging down underneath so that when the shells come out, the shell cases, I hit the shield at the back, drop down through the canvas shield and lay on the floor. The idea of the chute is that when these shell cases come out, they're very, very hot. So unless you've got some protection, somebody could be there and get one drop on the lap or drop on the knee or drop on the shoulder. So you have this shield and a chute, so they drop down on the floor. I gets underneath and up the other side because I couldn't get by it, and unless I climbed out the turret down the other side. I pulls the shell up, which I would think was probably the one that we'd taken out, which had been half in and half out. And not being a gunner in the tank, I loaded the shell in the correct manner, which is that when you're on the loading side of the gun, you heave the shell in, where they're quite large things, these shells, 75 millimetres. I mean, you're talking of something getting on for about 2.5 to 3 feet long. They're quite heavy. And you heave it up over the top of the shield, and of course, your side, the loader's side, the shield is cut away so you can get into the breech. You put the nose in, into the block, because you drop the block to open it, you see. You put the nose in, support it with your left hand, put your right hand over, and your four fingers of the hand, excluding the thumb, you put down the base of the shell and flip it, basically following it in all the way, so your hand follows all the way into the breech. And when it hit, when the rim hits the breech, it triggers the two levers, and that allows the block to come up and close the breech. Well, you'd think, well, your fingers are going to get trapped, but they don't, because it's shaped at the top, chamfered, so, and very smart lock, so that when it comes up, although your fingers are still there, there's no danger of trapping your fingers. It comes up and your fingers come out off the top of the gun, you see. Well, the gun then should be primed, ready for firing. But I used to teach in gunnery that you can have what is known as a premature shell. It's a shell that for some reason, either a fault in assembly or whatever, can go off without being fired. It'll go off on its own accord, and they refer to them as a premature shell. And it's taught in the gunnery schools, and there is a drill for it. That if you get a premature shell,